Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. No one believes that American consumers will suddenly abandon the over 200 million gas-powered cars they drive today. But interest in electric-powered vehicles is clearly growing. At least 30 car companies are in the race to develop a safe, affordable, and easy-to-charge electric vehicle. And many say that the technological issues that sank earlier efforts have been largely resolved. Joining me in the studio to talk about the electric car market, Chelsea Sexton. She's co-founder of Plug-in America. Les Goldman is an attorney representing battery company A123 Systems. And joining us by phone from Los Angeles, John O'Dell. He's senior editor of Edmunds.com. You can join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Les Goldman, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And good morning to you, John O'Dell.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us, Chelsea Sexton.
Thank you for having us.
Chelsea, you were part of the team at General Motors in the late 1990s, and that was, you were working there on the EVI, am I pronouncing that?
The EV1, yes.
EV1, the car that was highlighted in the movie, Who Killed the Electric Car. Tell us about the efforts now. What's going on with the development of the electric car?
Well, the good thing is there are a lot of things coming. There's not nearly enough available yet, but there are half a dozen automakers that are all working on pure electric vehicles again, and another bunch that are working on plug-in hybrids, which are kind of the best of both worlds between an EV and a hybrid. So you might have 20 or 40 miles of electric range and then also have a backup hybrid system. So you can go Monday through Friday without using gasoline and still drive long distance on the weekend.
So how do they differ from what GM was trying to develop back then?
Well, in the late 90s, six of the major automakers made pure electric vehicles, which would go somewhere between 100 and 150 miles on a charge, but required no gasoline at all. A lot of drivers absolutely loved them. We had waiting lists for by the thousands for these little vehicles, but the auto companies didn't really want to be in that business at that time, and so they ended up reclaiming the vehicles and crushing them.
Well, crushing them?
Crushing them.
After all that work had gone into them, they ended up crushing them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no precedent in history for an automaker taking back all of something and destroying it, but that's what happened.
So now you've got Toyota, you've got Honda, you've got Ford and GM all producing.
Now we've got an absolute horse race among automakers to be the first back to market with plug-in cars, which is fantastic because what it means for consumers is you'll have more choices tomorrow in what to drive. You won't be completely dependent on gasoline anymore.
I gather you were laid off from GM.
I was definitely laid off.
You were one of thousands laid off.
At the time, I was more like one of dozens, but yes, yeah, so it's become, you know, hundreds of thousands, unfortunately.
John O'Dell, what do we know about just how interested consumers are now in electric cars?
We know that as the price of gasoline rises, consumers get more and more interested, and as the price of gasoline falls, they seem to get a little less interested. There's a very hardcore of people, and it's growing, who are quite enthusiastic about the idea of electric vehicles. There's another larger group that are enthusiastic about anything that'll help save money.
Do you really see electric cars as mass-produced and as part of our future?
I do. I'm not as sanguine as some about how quickly it will happen, but I do believe it will happen.
Turning to you now, Les Goldman, explain just how electric cars work.
The wheels of a pure electric car are driven by an onboard electric storage system, which you plug in to get your source of power, and then once you've used that up, it doesn't go anymore. A hybrid, a plug-in hybrid, has a battery on board, but also has a relatively small gasoline engine. That gasoline engine kicks on when you either need to accelerate fast or when you've used up all the storage from the plug-in that you did the night before, let's say. So apropos of what Chelsea was saying, for now, that gives you the maximum flexibility. You don't have to worry about not finding a plug when you get to the end of your range. But if you're commuting in the city, for example, and I've been driving a prototype for the last year and a half, actually.
Have you got it with you today?
I don't have it with me today, but I'll be glad
to see it.
I'll bring it back and I'll show it to you, or I'll bring it back in a little while, actually, because I had to come down here from on a cab. But in any event, the whole concept is that I commute from Chevy Chase about 9 miles down to an office at Kitty Corner to the White House. And so that's 18 miles a day. The supplemental battery that I have in the spare tire well of the Prius, just a regular stock Prius that anybody can buy, and this module will soon be offered and anyone can buy it as well, lets you go approximately 30 to 35 miles on predominantly electricity. I put gasoline in that car every 6 to 8 weeks, and I'm averaging in that year and a half about 120 miles per gallon. So that's here now. It can be done in a car that people are able to buy and use. And my sense in driving this car around is that there is a thirst amongst the American public for these kind of solutions, that what we need, given that it's now becoming feasible and people are focusing on it, we need the leadership to get the word out, and we need the incentives to kickstart this revolution.
The whole question has to center on the batteries, the battery technology, and how that's advanced in the last few years. How different is that technology from what it was, say, 5-10 years ago?
It is substantially different. It's substantially different even from what it was just a couple years ago. A battery that weighs about 140 pounds, which fits in the spare tire well of most hybrids, and is able to go the 30 to 35 miles, compares to a battery just a couple years ago that maybe weighed 300 pounds and could go about a mile and a half. That's the kind of advances that we've seen in an actually smaller space. You can travel even further because of the advance in terms of the compactness, the safeness, the durability, and the ability to make that work for consumers.
John O'Dell, who are the major players here among the electric car manufacturers? I understand there are more than 30 companies out there moving in this direction.
There are quite a few companies, particularly if you're including pure EVs, the plug-in electrics, and fuel cell electrics. And by the way, the battery electric or the plug-in electric is one variety. There's also still a lot of hope that at some point we have the fuel cell electric vehicle, which ultimately drives just like a plug-in, except you don't need a plug at all. You use a hydrogen fuel. But be that as it may, the major players are the major automakers. They've got the money. There are a couple. I think Tesla is the only company that's got a full functioning high speed long distance EV on the road in any numbers today, but there are several others that are working on it. But the leaders are the major automakers, because they've frankly got all the money.
And Chelsea, earlier you heard John O'Dell say, well, now that the price of gasoline is dipping, maybe the interest in electric cars will dip as well. Is that your thinking?
Well, I certainly a lot of this interest has been correlated to gas prices. However, I think that we feel a little bit burned by seeing how high they could go. And I think our memory will probably not be as short as, you know, some people suspect. At the same time, this used to be seen very much as an environmental movement. It never has been, but that's how it was seen. And now we have people that for all kinds of reasons are getting interested. The price of gas, environmental reasons, climate change, but also energy security. Not wanting to rely on countries that don't like us for our fuel. So even if one of those reasons went away or was lessened, you still have the other variety of reasons that people come to this particular table. So yes, it'll take a little while to grow and to really become mass production vehicles, but it's certainly out there and it's coming and it's not going to stop this time.
But that image of these automobile companies and especially GM just squashing these prototypes, I gather, that were already in the works. Who's to say that they might not revert to that? Is it now that you have some 30 companies involved that would preclude that kind of thing happening again?
Well, the reality is it's up to us to make sure it doesn't happen again. It is up to consumers. What we are starting to see is the auto industry is turning around and having to be more responsive to consumer demand because especially the domestic companies are failing so badly. What that does is put more responsibility on consumers to ask for what they want.
Less.
There's a fundamental change, I think, occurring in the consciousness of the American consumer, who in this regard, I believe, is ahead of the politicians. But and here's sort of the short form of how to look at this. 98% of all our transportation is on oil. 2% of all of our electricity is generated by oil. 50% of that electricity generation sits idle at night. If we switch from foreign oil to domestic electricity, we will save 80% of our imports.
Les Goldman, he's an attorney in private practice representing battery company A123 Systems. You're invited to join the conversation after a short break. Stay with us. And as we talk about electric-powered vehicles, we're joined now by one of the major manufacturers, Elon Musk. He's chair of Tesla Motors. He's on the phone with us from Los Angeles. Good morning, sir. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I gather the Tesla Roadster is said by some to be leading in the market. Tell us about the Roadster, both performance and an important detail, the price.
Sure. Well, the Roadster is intended to be a high-performance sports car, albeit an electric car, and it's faster in acceleration than any Aston Martin or I think any Ferrari except the Enzo supercar. 0 to 60 is 3.9 seconds. It has a range of almost 250 miles, and and it handles very well. It's really the first time there's been a compelling electric car at a compelling price, I think, since the early part of the 20th century.
And the price is?
And the price is $109,000.
That's what I had heard, and my jaw dropped when I heard it. How many of these Tesla cars are on the road?
Well, we've just started production, and so we have about almost 30 that have been made, and we're increasing the production ramp to 10 cars per week next month, and by early next year we'll be at about 40 cars per week. Our production rate is approximately 2,000 cars a year.
But now, what's in the works for the rest of us who don't have $109,000 to spend on a car?
Sure. Well, the Roadster is just intended to prove out the technology, and it has. And so what we're working on right now is Model 2, which is our sedan, and that's a larger car with more functionality. It's a five-passenger, four-door luxury sports sedan, about the size of Maserati Quattroporte or a good-sized Mercedes, and that's going to have a starting price of
$59,000. And if it's battery powered, how come you're getting 225 miles between charges? I mean, what kind of battery are you using? How much does that battery weigh?
Sure. Well, the battery technology is, at the chemistry level, is lithium ion. So in many ways, similar to what you have in your laptop, although much more sophisticated. And it's really a combination of Tesla's advanced battery pack combined with our very efficient motor, transmission, power electronics, and then taking care throughout the vehicle to ensure that the drag is low, the weight is low.
Hmm.
All these factors actually are important in ensuring that the range is well over 200 miles.
Sure.
And in fact, for the sedan, we're going to offer a version of the sedan with a range of over 300 miles.
And how much will that battery weigh?
It's on the order of 1,000 pounds.
And so the total weight of that electric car will be what?
Well, the Tesla Roadster is actually quite a light car. It's only 2,650 pounds.
I see.
But, of course, a large proportion of that is battery. In the case of the sedan, we're talking about a car that's probably around 4,000 pounds. So proportionately, the battery is less.
So where do you see the electric car industry heading over the next 5 years?
I see rapid growth in the electric car business. In fact, what I predicted is that within less than 30 years, a majority of all new cars made will be electric. And I don't mean hybrid, I mean pure electric.
Mm-hmm. And from your perspective, what are the biggest challenges aside from price?
Well, it's a tough technology problem. I mean, in general, if you look at any new technology, whether it be laptops, cell phones, or even the early days of gasoline engine cars, these were initially very expensive and accessible only to the wealthy. And so I think this is generally true of new technologies, that it takes time to optimize them, particularly if they're physical objects. It's really mind-boggling that that people can buy a car with all of its functionality for such a small price, given how complex the device it is.
Now, I presume you've got a website where people can see one of these Roadsters?
The website is simply teslamotors.com.
Teslamotors.com.
Yeah, and we actually have sales and service centers that are in Los Angeles and in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we'll be opening more soon in Miami, New York, Seattle, Denver, Chicago, and a number of other cities.
I'm interested that you did not mention Washington, D.C.
Oh, I should have mentioned Washington, D.C., because we will have one there.
In how long?
I would say probably sometime toward the end of next year.
Interesting. I'll look forward to seeing that car. And we've been talking with Elon Musk, chair of Tesla Motors. He's been on the phone with us from Los Angeles. Any questions from you, Les Goldman?
No, not really.
No questions. You think that this is a done deal that's going to move forward?
I think that Tesla is playing an important role in opening up the marketplace at a spot, as was indicated, in a kind of higher range. I think it's just as important that we make the vehicles, as they're moving in the direction, available to the everyday consumer. And I would just make the point that since the vast majority of Americans, something like 70%, don't actually drive more than 28 miles a day, something with much less capacity that would therefore weigh less and cost less could suit an awful lot of the national security objective of getting us off of foreign oil and be more economical, too. And there's a place for each of these kind of vehicles in the usage patterns for the whole country. So they're beginning, and there's other places to look as well.
John O'Dell, any questions for Elon Musk?
Not any questions. A couple of observations.
Sure.
I've driven the Tesla. It's a wonderful vehicle for what it is, and it was never intended to be a vehicle for every man. But I would like to point out that range that's always cited is pretty much the same as the EPA ranges that are always cited in car commercials for regular vehicles. That's a fairly moderate driving speed and cycle. The Tesla is sold as a high-performance roadster, and if you drive it as one, you get about half that range, effectively, maybe 120 to 140 miles. And that's going to be the same with any electric vehicle, as it is with any gas vehicle, the harder you drive it, and Americans tend to drive on the highway at 80 miles an hour, not 65, you're going to drain the fuel a lot faster. The other point, and again, I am a big fan of electric vehicles. I always have been. I think plug-ins and electrics are going to ultimately save us. But we make 300,000 cars a week in this country, and as Mr. Musk pointed out, they're looking at ramping up to 2,000 a year. You can see the difference and the challenge of replacing the gasoline vehicle, the internal combustion engine vehicle, with whether they're plug-ins, hybrids, or all electric vehicles. There's a ways to go. And people need to be aware of that,
okay.
Particularly
and
those who are interested in pushing this technology.
And final question for you, Elon Musk. How long do you think it's going to take to get your vehicle down to a price of, say, $35,000?
Well, actually, we're working on that as a long-term objective. In fact, if we thought we could produce a compelling electric car today at that price, that's what we would have started out with. The objective of Tesla is, in fact, and has been from the very beginning, to make cars that are affordable to everyone. It's just that, going back to what I was saying about technology earlier, it takes time to optimize the technology. And so with Model 2, we're cutting the price in half and increasing the volume by a factor of 10. So our sedan will be at 20,000 units a year.
Elon Musk, he's chair of Tesla Motors. You wanted to ask one more question, Lance.
I just make one observation, and again, I think it's a question of how you look at the balance in this whole situation. You can go today up in Rockville, a suburb of Washington, to Fitzgerald Toyota and order a new Prius with one of the modules that I've been testing. And the total package, the car and the battery, which will average 100-plus miles per gallon, depending on how hard you drive it, for about $34,000.
Indeed.
So if your range is in 30 to 35 miles with the lighter weight and a very well-designed car with a weaker battery, it's here today, and the American public, again, I come back to the point I made before, needs the leadership to make this happen and put an emphasis on it, given how badly foreign oil is hurting us economically and security-wise.
Indeed. And Elon Musk, thanks for joining us. I'll look forward to seeing that Tesla motor car coming here to Washington, D.C.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And the question becomes, if we have all these cars on the road running on electricity, where is that electricity going to come from?
Well, here's the cool thing. We can actually accommodate 180 million plug-in cars right now on existing generating capacity. Because most vehicles charge at night when people are sleeping. You know, you charge when it's most convenient. And so you don't care how long it takes to charge as long as it's full when you leave in the morning. So we don't require any new generating capacity of any kind in order to start putting these cars on the road and indeed to convert 80% of our nation's fleet.
And what about emissions? What's the potential there?
Well, given the current grid, assuming you don't have solar power or anything like that, we're 52% coal, which isn't fantastic. But even given that, plug-in cars are about twice as clean as your cleaner gas cars. That's the worst-case scenario, twice as clean. So what that means is the grid will get cleaner over time, and your car will therefore get cleaner over time. So from an emissions perspective, the dirtiest day your car will ever have is the day you drive it off the showroom floor.
Dirtiest day.
Dirtiest day.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Les Goldman, to what extent do we now have the existing capacity on the grid to power hundreds of thousands of electric cars?
Well, I think Chelsea just touched on this, and I touched on it earlier when I told you about the 98% on oil and 2% electric generation on oil. 50% of all the electric generation capacity lies idle at night. It's a resource that is there and can support anywhere. We have 240 million cars in total. We could do anywhere from 120 to 160 million, Chelsea said, in the neighborhood, 170 million cars on just the capacity we have today. Because if you plug in like I do at night at home and you're making use of incremental electricity that would not have otherwise been generated, you don't have to add any capacity to do the fleet.
How is my electricity bill going to go up?
I can actually answer that question because I've monitored at my house.
Good.
A 4.5 hour charge that takes me about 30 to 35 miles, depending on how hard I drive and how hard I accelerate, costs me 60 cents for that 30 to 35 miles. Now, you go do the math, and that's about the equivalent of $1 a gallon of gas instead of $4 a gallon of gas.
And how long can these batteries last?
Different companies have different metrics, but the ones that are being used and the ones that I've been driving around are able to cycle, because of the new kind of technology, up to 7,000 times, which means that for the average driver, the battery will far outlast the car. That's part of the breakthrough of these new technologies.
And John O'Dell, some people have pointed out that the major components come from Asia, the batteries themselves, and that we could once again find ourselves dependent on a foreign country. Do you agree?
Yeah, very much so. In fact, that's a debate that's just getting a little bit of currency. It's starting to be discussed in Detroit and in Washington. I believe right now, and I believe Mr. Goldman's firm, A123, uses a lithium-ion chemistry. Most people feel that that's going to be the battery of at least the near future. And about 40% of the lithium in use today comes out of I believe it's about 40% comes out of South America, and about 50% comes or will be coming from China. So there is lithium in the U.S., but our lithium mines pretty much all shut down a while ago because it wasn't seen as a profitable venture. And, you know, there's going to have to be a lot of work done to start internalizing that power source, or yes, we will end up dependent for another fuel source on other countries.
Indeed. And what about the country's infrastructure? Would it have to change to accommodate the new electric cars? Chelsea?
No, what's really cool is electricity is ubiquitous. We have outlets everywhere. Would we want to install a few public stations that were a bit more available? Sure. But the infrastructure cost would be a fraction of any other alternative fuel that we're looking at.
John O'Dell, do you want to comment?
Oh, I agree. But when we're talking about plug-in hybrids, we've pretty much got what we need. When you talk about an all-electric vehicle, the problem that existed, one of the problems that existed 10 years ago still exists today, and that is we're talking cars that are a lot more expensive than what the average person spends today on a vehicle. Even if we get them down into the $25,000 and $30,000 bracket, most people cannot afford to buy a car that's a commuter car and a car that they use for everything else. We're going to need a fast charging infrastructure, because when I buy my electric car, I live in Los Angeles. I'm going to be able or want to be able to drive it to Washington D.C. once in a while. I may never do it, but I'm going to want to do it. And I can't afford to plug it into a 110 outlet at a hotel or a motel and wait for 12 hours or 10 hours or 8 hours for it to refill in between charges. So I'm going to need a fast charging infrastructure all the way across the country that'll fill me up in 15 minutes, or that car is less utilitarian than I've been trained to expect from my vehicle.
John O'Dell, he's senior editor of Edmunds.com. You can go to his website at greencaradvisor.com. Short break. We'll take your calls when we return.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Glenn Campbell on his 50 years in the music business. He's got a new album. Join us.
Welcome back, and it's time to open the phones as we talk about the growing interest in and development of the new electric cars. Let's go first to Holland, Michigan. Good morning, Junior. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm on a cell, so if I break up, I apologize, but I got some questions. I will hang up and listen.
All right.
Coming from West Michigan, obviously you guys know about Michigan having a lot of job losses, you know, and the market and all, you know, the gas, economy. Everything's going up and everything, you know, and people losing jobs.
Right.
With these cars are coming up, I think one of your guests there answered my question about the price. You know, not everybody can afford it, but that's
right.
Going to be, you know. Now, for... Are these new cars that are coming out, are they going to open up new jobs? I mean, are people going to be able to say, or bid on some, you know... with GM, say, listen, we'll build some of these products, to offer new jobs so that people can afford these cars, you know, in the long run. I'm looking at the big picture.
Okay.
Future.
All right.
Now, So insurance-wise, I mean, do insurance companies to insure these vehicles, is there a tax incentive for or not?
All right, you're breaking up, Junior. Let's take these questions. What about new jobs, Chelsea?
Absolutely. Someone's got to build the cars. And that's a
huge...
But
are they going to be built here or abroad?
Well, it'll vary by manufacturer. Certainly the domestic manufacturers want to build their cars here. You know, the Prius is currently built in Japan, but a lot of the hybrids are coming to the U.S. So there are a lot of empty plants that will be filled again with cars and jobs. And it should be noted that of all of the different plug-in cars that are being worked on, not all the automakers have announced their pricing, but they're all aiming for the $25,000 to $40,000 price range. These are not all Teslas that are coming. Much as that car is wicked fun to drive, I can't afford one either.
You have driven it.
I have driven it. I appreciate torque and horsepower more than most guys. It is lots and lots of fun. But what we're starting to see are very reasonably priced cars, you know, Accord and Camry type of pricing. So this is not out of the realm of possibility.
What about insurance and how companies are approaching this, John O'Dell?
I can't really answer that. It's not an area that I've looked at. One presumes that the vehicles are not going to be particularly more expensive to insure than a gas car.
Les Goldman.
Yes, we've taken a hard look at that, given that we're now in the process of marketing an actual battery, and there's both warranties as well as insurance covers it. And let me say that the current battery market is dominated by Asia, but the battery that I've been driving is made by an American company, and it's an American innovation. Indeed, the advent of this approach to transportation, the electrification, and the advancement of the technology is a way to create American jobs and leapfrog over. The Volt, which GM is working on, is going to be a car that will produce jobs, that will produce interest, and a patriotism, if you will, in buying American and going electric all at the same time. And the tax credits that the gentleman asked about are what we're fighting for in the energy bill in the Congress right now to kickstart this revolution so people will be more inclined to learn about it and start out buying them now so that we can get a 2 or 3 or 4 year head start on making the transition that we're all talking about.
Here's an email from Michael in Baltimore who says, to support the clean plug-in electric car, won't we indirectly be using coal as the fuel of choice, since that's what most electric plants use to create electricity? Won't the resulting increase in air pollution offset the gains in driving clean cars? John O'Dell.
You can game the numbers a whole lot of ways, but yes, that's one of the concerns, is that with 52% coal, and we have some states where the electricity is virtually all coal, you could have increases in overall pollution. As Chelsea pointed out, you know, the whole world is working towards cleaning up electric generation, and one presumes that moving forward, things are going to get better. Until we reach a point of saturation, which is a few hundred thousand or millions of vehicles from now, you know, I don't think it's an overriding issue. The amount of pollution that might come from the electricity that we would be generating.
All right, to Indianapolis. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Yeah, I want to talk about, I had read something, it has to have been 20 years ago in Popular Science, I believe, about a possible electrolytic fluid that could be at like a gas station and pumped into the car, and the old spent fluid cycled back out into tanks, and that this fluid would hold the charge, and that solves the problem of a limited range with a battery, and it's, you know, something that could be transferred within 5-10 minutes. I've never heard anything since then about that technology. I'm just kind of curious if you could have that along with the battery, and I'll take my question off the air.
All right. Thanks, John O'Dell.
I have a feeling Les is going to be better at that one since he's in the battery business, but I believe 20 years ago you were talking about the electrolyte fluids for lead-acid batteries. We're not talking very much range, and we're talking a battery that is not a suitable battery for the kind of demand we place on a modern automobile.
All right.
The batteries that are being made today are dry batteries in any event.
Okay. And to Steve in Raleigh, North Carolina, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering what the guests think about the potential for the EMF levels that are generated by the battery and the other electrical system components and wires, that could be harmful to passengers. We bought a Prius and we love it, but since then we've gotten in touch with this sort of online discussion that's going on about those levels and the potential danger and whether the standards in the United States are stringent enough, and the fact that in some other countries the manufacturers are actually creating shields for some of the components. So
Les
Goldman.
We're a little
concerned about that.
Sure. Les.
I think if there's going to be an issue in that regard, probably the cell phones that we all hold to our heads are even more serious.
But this is a far larger battery we're talking about.
Yes, it is. But we are unaware of any evidence today that suggests that within the containment of the vehicle and within the containment of the battery itself, that a passenger in the car, I mean, there's a big difference between holding a microwave right next to your head.
Sure.
And the kind
sitting.
Of insulation that you have and the way it's encapsulated. I know even the supplemental modules, but I have not seen anything that suggests that that's
Chelsea.
A problem.
Chelsea?
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget, we have a dozen years of experience with plug-in cars. You know, many of them are crushed, some are still on the road, but we've been down some of these paths before.
Has anybody done any studies on this?
Yeah, actually, and what we have found are a lot of gas cars are actually worse with EMF than a lot of plug-in cars. Yeah, the auto companies are used to dealing with these sorts of things, shielding not only batteries but electronics as they put more and more electronics into regular cars. So it's certainly something we want to pay attention to, but it's not as huge of an issue, I don't think, as some people are
Steve, does
about.
That answer it?
Yeah, the specific concern I think that I heard was with some of the cabling, the battery in the back and a cable that runs power to the front, and if that generates a problem for passengers in the back seat.
It could. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Volvo had a problem with that, or at least an alleged problem with that in some of their regular cars not too terribly long ago. So it happens, but both the industry and government are going to be on it as we get more and more vehicles out.
All right, Steve, thanks for your call. Let's go now to Hollywood, Florida. Hi there, Michael.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
When I was in Peru last year, I was introduced to the Moto Taxi, which is a three-wheeled bike with a small carriage on the back. And I was wondering, has anybody developed a battery-powered motorcycle?
Chelsea.
Yeah, there are several out there, and especially in the three-wheeled world, there's a company called Aptera in San Diego, California, that's getting quite a bit of attention. Three-wheeled cars are considered motorcycles and so therefore don't have to go through crash testing, which makes them quite attractive to small companies that don't have a lot of resources. There are also some electric scooters and motorcycles out there as well. Zero Motorcycle is probably the most popular one right now.
Here's an email from Michael in Triangle, Virginia, who says, how does the air conditioning and heating work on these cars, Les?
Actually, that's a very good question. The air conditioning maybe in the summertime costs you, if you use it all the time on a warm, humid day in Washington, maybe 5 to 8 miles per gallon. Not all that significant at all. I will say, though, that the heating on cars that currently exist with the supplemental module, when the engine comes on and all you're doing is using it for heat, then that's very inefficient, and that substantially reduces in the wintertime on a real cold day your mileage, which it also does for the car without the supplemental electric system.
So, John O'Dell, what does the next administration need to do to support the development of the electric car industry? What do you see happening?
Well, first, it needs to want to support it, and then it needs to take a good hard look at where we're putting all of our energy and other dollars and make some choices. As Mr. Musk pointed out, and I think others on the panel have, most of these vehicles that are coming online are still quasi-experimental. They're very low-volume vehicles, and the price has got to be high because unless the manufacturers are going to underwrite the difference, and most of our manufacturers are in pretty deep doo-doo these days financially. So we're going to need federal tax credits. We're going to need some policies that that encourage the manufacture and development of both the battery, the infrastructure for charging that battery all over the country, and the manufacturer of the vehicles.
Here is an email from Galen, who says, I think the automakers are still being too narrow-minded. After World War II, the president pushed the car makers to build our interstate highways. With the same kind of foresight, we could build all electric highways right over the existing interstates. Cars could then be powered right from these roads, and a driver could just enter the destination city and let the car drive itself. Wow, he's really looking ahead. And then he goes on to say semi-trailers loaded with products could be sent from city to city without any drivers at all. Chelsea, you see it that way, too.
Well, certainly there are a lot of people that are looking very far ahead, and these are really intriguing ideas. What we need to keep in perspective is that that's just not needed to start putting plug-in cars on the road. You know, through-the-road inductive charging is, you know, a fantastic idea. But in the meantime, we have electricity. All we need are cars. What has held this back, as much as I want more political will and more corporate will and all of that, what has always held us back is the lack of vehicles. There has never been a lack of demand. It's just a lack of product.
So do you see that product beginning to emerge in the numbers that you want to see?
I am hopeful. I am guardedly optimistic based on the announcements. Until I see cars in showrooms, we still have a ways to go.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was discussing with the lady two versions of cars that I heard of recently. One was developed in France. It was run entirely by compressed air. The car itself cost about $15,000, and it went about 200 miles per charge, and that's all there is to it. And then the second question I asked was, why can't we utilize some of the techniques that are used by Brazil and Argentina, who ran their cars solely on alcohol, which many people could develop in their own backyards as a small stove and supply their own fuel for the...
And perhaps get arrested in the process. What about
several
the...
Several have been arrested.
Yeah, indeed. Chelsea, what about the compressed air?
The compressed air car is quite popular in theory. So you have to, again, look at the energy equation. So it does take a tremendous amount of electricity to compress the air and put it in a car and then try to use that to actually power the vehicle. You'd be better off just taking the same electricity and putting it in the battery in the first place. And then on the biofuels, we absolutely love them for the secondary fuel in a plug-in hybrid. You know, certainly electricity solely as a pure electric car will not work for absolutely everybody. However, it is still cleaner, cheaper, domestic compared to every other fuel. And especially with regard to the biofuels, it's much cheaper.
I want to come back to this question that seems to be looming around here. If you've got an electric vehicle, as you have less, that you plug in each night you've traveled, as you said, about 28, 30 miles a day, what about the family who wants one car that's going to make it across country? How are you going to do that? Or are you going to have two cars for now?
No, I think it. The whole point that we've been making is that the plug-in hybrid gives you maximum flexibility. You can use the electric whenever you can find a plug. And you can also make that once-in-a-while trip across the country utilizing gasoline and getting a charge at the motels where you stop overnight. You'll use a bit more gasoline, but the car will be able to do everything you need in one car, and that's the beauty of the plug-in hybrid with the advanced batteries.
Okay, so that's the plug-in hybrid. What about a totally electric car, Chelsea?
I don't think we'll see a lot of totally electric cars driving cross country, but we have to also keep in mind what they were made for. There's not a single gas car on the road today that's the car for everybody. The same will apply to these other technologies. Our entire goal is to get the choice of both pure electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids out there so people can pick what works best for them. You know, with pure electric vehicles, you use a microwave analogy a lot. You use your microwave every day, but you'd never cook your Thanksgiving turkey in the thing. It still doesn't mean it doesn't serve you 90% of the time. Same thing with a pure electric car. 90% of the time, it will do everything you need, and a week or two a year, you'll get on a plane for your vacation or rent a car.
What's your best guess, John O'Dell, as to the percentage of electric-powered cars on the road 10 years from now?
10 years from now?
10 years.
Probably somewhere in the neighborhood of, I'd say, 5 to 10% of the fleet. I'm sorry, did you ask me pure electric cars or electric?
Well, either. Either
electric, you play 5 to 10% of the total.
And you agree with that, Les?
I believe that we have a million hybrids on the road today because we had tax credits. If the government provides a leadership, it could be 20 to 25 by then.
Les Goldman, he's an attorney in private practice representing battery company A123 Systems. John O'Dell, senior editor of Edmunds.com. And Chelsea Sexton, co-founder of Plug In America. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.